Psalm 29 is quite a lovely, interesting psalm. It's a nature psalm. It's about the cosmic God of a storm. So you've all been in storms, and think of the worst storm you've ever been in, the most powerful storm, and you're right into this psalm. It may even, it's suggested by some scholars, be an adaptation, because it's so natural, and every culture would have this. It may even come from an ancient Canaanite, because Baal, you know, the Baals of the Canaanite peoples, you know, the god of thunder and the storm, and the equivalent of Zeus in the Greek world. So you got all that playing here, the storm god. So it's a psalm of considerable poetic beauty and intense power. I wish I was better at Hebrew. I didn't bring it with me anyhow, but I could do it slowly with you. But believe me, it sounds wonderful in Hebrew, as you'd expect a poem, you know, with all the assonance. I'll give you a little bit. In the Hebrew text, there's a constant repetition of the Z sound, which gets the lightning. I remember, oh God, I've distracted myself, but I remember reading a wonderful poem called Lulu, I think, or it might have been Lalu, a French poem by, oh, I've nearly got it, someone in the 18th century, and it won't, I'm going back 30 years, excuse me, but it was a hunt, and there were dogs attacking the hind or something, and you, all the way through you heard the ash, ash, you could hear this coming, and you could just, when you read it in French, and the kids in class were just galvanized by the French, which I was teaching, of course, but it was, you could hear the dogs hunting in. Well, in this one, if I could do it, and I can't do it well with you, you've got the zzz, you hear the lightning and the thunder all the way through the poem. And I'll do one bit for you, man. In verses 1, there's this constant Q and K, the thunder coming through it. The numinous quality of a tempest reveals the sacred. This is for them. The tempest, which it came to all of us, it says something awesome, as the kids love to say. Verse 10 reassures us that God, who reveals his power in the flood, has also promised that the world will never again be destroyed by flood. Unfortunately, there's no text in the scripture which says it'll never be destroyed by fire. So they go for gold. So we've got hell's full of fire, purgatory's full of fire, the end of the world, it's all fire and brimstone. But none flood, because God said, I won't flood the world again. Had we had another story where the world was burnt to cinders, it would have been a lot better. There would have been a lot less drivel from pulpits, you know, and there would have been a little bit, we wouldn't have known what to do, but fire and water are the two big destructive elements. So they're all into fire. Well, you had some missions as young men and women, I hope, from the Redemptorists used to love it. Then the MSCs, which I happen to be one of, and this is quite well known. We had some wonderful MSCs in the last, you know, early century, 100 years ago and less. And they used to go around these country towns, and people couldn't believe them. We had an old bloke called Paddy Maloney, and he used to play the music, and it was a one-man band, really. And he was talking about God's love, and that's all he ever talked about. And, you know, so many country people couldn't go. They had all the fire and brimstone, and then they had all this love stuff. So, and we're still at it. We're still at it. As long as we don't think love is soft, otherwise we've lost everything. Yahweh's repeated 18 times in the psalm. The word voice, which is kol, got the k sound in it, occurs 7 times. So here we go. Let's start this pretty straightforward and simple psalm. And acclaim Yahweh, O heavenly beings. Acclaim the glory and might of Yahweh. Acclaim the glory of Yahweh's name. Prostrate yourself before Yahweh in his holy sanctuary. The voice of Yahweh, call Yahweh. Above the waters, the God of glory, Kabod is glory. Again, thunders Yahweh over the mighty waters. Call Yahweh Bakoah. The voice of Yahweh is powerful. Kol Yahweh Bakoa. Did you get it? You heard the thunder. The voice of Yahweh, full of majesty, the voice of Yahweh breaks the cedars, and the Yahweh breaks the cedars of Lebanon. So this is something quite powerful. He makes Lebanon skip like a calf, Syrian like a young wild ox. Syrian is one of the names for the great Mount Hermon. If you go to Israel, well, Israel's like this, and then there's this whopping big snow peak mountain which lifts you right up, and then you have the high plains of Lebanon, Baca Valley, and so on. So, and whereas Israel gradually goes down to hundreds of feet below sea level, doesn't it? It's a big rift in the world's surface. So they're looking at, and the mountain is like shaky with the thunder and the lightning and the stripping of the forest bare, and this mighty mountain is shaking, and the whole world is okay. Some other images from other places that have similar. Exodus 19:18, when it describes Mount Sinai at the time of God's coming down on the mountain and revealing the Ten Commandments and Moses. This is all drama. It's not, if you were there, you wouldn't, you wouldn't have seen anything, I don't suppose. But this is all powerful language to say this is a momentous moment. Mount Sinai was wrapped in smoke, says Exodus 19. Yahweh had descended upon it in fire. The smoke went up like the smoke of a kiln, while the whole mountain shook violently. It's probably like those of you who are married, probably the first time you kissed your beloved. You probably, if you wrote a poem about that, well, the whole world would have been thundering and lightning and shaking, I presume, across a crowded room or whatever you romantics get into. But it was probably quite a simple occurrence, but it wasn't simple because it was so much involved. Well, here it is. Here too. This was wonderful. The sea looked and fled. This is Psalm 114. Jordan turned back. The mountains skipped like rams. The hills like lambs. Why is it, O sea, that you flee? O Jordan, that you turn back? O mountains, that you skip like rams? O hills, that you skip like lambs? Why is this happening? And it goes on to say it's because God is present here. Yahweh, verse 8, shakes the wilderness of Kadesh. There's a few places called Kadesh, but the one we're talking about here is Kadesh Barnea. It's just south of Bathsheba. So the Dead Sea's here, and you're kind of just there in the top part of the Sinai Peninsula. So it was from Kadesh that Moses sent out some men to spy out the land of Canaan. You find that in Numbers 13. According to the legend, the springs of Kadesh were God's response to Moses striking the rock. You remember they ran out of water and he struck the rock. Well, that's their story about this amazing oasis. It's a wonderful oasis at Kadesh. So it's a miracle oasis, and it comes back, according to the legend, the folklore, to when Moses struck the rock. So they have stories attached to each of these natural places that reinforce their faith. They're not historical, for heaven's sake. They're not factual, but they're deeply meaningful in their religious understanding, mythical understanding of their world. It's probable that much of the time spent in the wilderness before crossing into Jordan was spent at Kadesh. They tried to get in from the south, but the Amalekites stopped them. So they had 40 years of wandering, and they eventually came in from across the Jordan. Here's Psalm 77. When the waters saw you, O God, when the waters saw you, they were afraid. The very deep trembled. The clouds poured out water. The skies thundered. Your arrows flashed on every side. That's Psalm 77, verse 16. And very similar imagery used here, only by Matthew, at the death of Jesus. And please read it as a Shakespearean, powerful drama, but not as a fact. Because you're misreading the literature. Matthew, when he says, at Jesus' death, he says, the earth shook and the rocks were split. Well, what's he telling us? Mark didn't say it, Luke didn't say it, John didn't say it, I don't care who didn't say it. Matthew did say it. So isn't he picking up all this literature by saying, when Jesus died, this was a cosmic event of the most extraordinary power. And the way you talk about cosmic events of the most extraordinary power is with this kind of language. The earth shook, the rocks were split. He even goes on to talk about the dead came out of their tombs and appeared to many. This is a resurrection event. This is about life, you know, coming from the grave. No one knocked on anybody's door and Uncle Jack, who'd been dead 10 years, kind of said, I just thought I'd come back to let you know it's very significant. I mean, surely that's not what we're talking about. I mean, we don't have to think that. I mean, that's just a silliness of our mind, unable to. And if people think like that, with that fundamentalist attitude, I don't know what you do except send them off to Bell Shakespeare and let them laugh at some wonderful Shakespearean drama. I don't know what you do to try and help them get beyond. I'll just come in a moment. So we conclude verse 9. The voice of Yahweh causes the oaks to whirl, strips the forest bare. In his temple all cry, glory. And Yahweh sits enthroned above the flood. Another interesting little bit of information for you. The word used for flood here in the Hebrew is mabul. And the only time, apart from this text, where mabul is used in the Hebrew, there's a lot of words for flood. The word the only is in the genitive narrative of Genesis, of the flood. Chapter 6 to 9 of Genesis. So this is not a flood any more than the Genesis chapter 6 to 9 is about a flood of water, I mean, like rivers breaking their banks or the ice age melting or the water breaking through the Bosphorus or, and I'm sure all these things have happened. And you can tell from archaeology that in certain parts of the world there were massive floods in history. The flood is the image for what we're talking about here. It's not a description of what actually happened historically in the book of Genesis. Of course it isn't. It's about a cosmic flood. It's about flood being used as a powerful image for destruction. And it's really, Genesis is talking about how sin can destroy the world. Of course, sin can. And the only thing that stopped sin destroying the world, and it was the sin of violence, if you read Genesis chapter 4, chapter 5, building up, they're all violent sins, and it got more violent and more violent, and the words used, and then this flood, we destroyed the earth, we can, by violence, except that there was a Noah. You can be the Noah if you wish. There was one person who was open to God's grace, and so the world could not be destroyed. No matter how much evil there was there, there was a light, an opening to grace. And because Noah was there, and in the temple, which it is, it's not a boat, the temple which was floating above the chaos, above the mabul, the cosmic flood. Do you get me the difference? It was the waters above and the waters beneath. It was a deconstruction of the whole 7 days of creation. It's better than Shakespeare, not worse. And not tinier. And don't let anybody pick it into that little world. It's a massive thing about what I could do to the world and you could do to the world and the Pentagon can do to the world or the jihad, you know? It's about real destructive power here and how what God is asking for us is justice. Because he's described as a just man, Noah. In other words, a man who wants the truth, justice, God's will to be done. Well, this word, which you don't find anywhere else, when they talk about floods in the Bible, they don't talk about a mabul, because floods are floods. I mean, you've seen a flood, I've seen a flood, little ones, big ones, we've heard about them, archaeology's full of them, examples of them. But they're only the image for the flood in the Bible. Well, here it is. Yahweh sits enthroned above all this. Yahweh sits enthroned as king forever. Yahweh gives might to his people. Yahweh blesses his people with peace. Peace, that wonderful word shalom, which means harmony. The best image I've got for peace, for me, is an orchestra, where every instrument is playing absolutely right on and with exactly the right amount of pitch and volume and everything, and every instrument is sensitive to everybody else, and you have this final resolution by Beethoven of a whole movement, and you hear, and it says, really lifts you right up, and everything's needed, even the triangle's needed. Every instrument is right on cue. That's peace, because it resolves everything. But it's full of life, full of energy. Controlled, well, sensitive energy. Well, God is the one who blesses the world with that energetic, creative, wonderful love thing that we're all asked to give. Again, if I could go back to the New Testament, what is Matthew talking about in chapter 8, if not something about this? When Matthew writes his drama, when he dramatizes, meaning goes to the depth of what happened in Jesus' life, where's he going to find words to talk about what was really going on? I don't mean what a Pharisee would see or a casual observer would see. I mean, so what casual observers would see? And what, I'm not talking about what anyone would see if they just had their eyes. I'm talking about what a blind disciple would have seen, you know, what someone with a heart attuned would have seen. So what was happening in the life of Jesus? They're going to have to describe it with their language, with their Shakespeare, which is the Old Testament, which is the book of Exodus, which is Psalm 29. And here, a windstorm arose on the sea. Sea is always an image of chaos in the biblical text, because they're not seafarers, they're not Phoenicians, they're land people. And the sea often lost lives to the sea, and it was mysterious, and they kind of avoided it. So, because water, you can't fence it, and you can't plough it, and you can't control it. It's all a pretty powerful thing. So the windstorm is on the sea, so great that the boat, and surely the boat is an image for the church in anywhere, in a persecuted church in Jerusalem, certainly the church in Rome, Nero. This is all written after Nero and the fire of Rome and the murder and stuff that went on in there. So the boat, the bark of Peter, the boat of the church, is being swamped by the waves. Okay. And he's asleep. Right back to our other psalm, silent. Where's Jesus? He's asleep. Nothing's happening. God doesn't seem to care about what's happening to southern Sudan. Millions of animists and Christians being just slaughtered by the powers that be in their country. And dreadful stuff. And God seems to be silent. Well, they went and they woke him up, saying, Lord, save us, we're perishing. We're going under. Exactly the cry of that earlier psalm. And he said to them, why are you afraid, you of little faith? And interesting to note, see the distinction here. It's a good one, and it's perfectly consistent with the whole of the New Testament. Faith is not the opposite of doubt. Please never think that. Doubting is what we should be doing all the time. Doubt is the edge of a rational mind questioning, searching, unsure, unsatisfied with the answers. No answer satisfies us as far as God goes. If it does, well, you're just far too small in your questions. We're talking about God here. We're talking, and any answer from a catechism or anywhere else is too tiny for the mystery. Of course it is. It has to be too tiny. So doubts are what we have all the time. Oh, you mightn't have them all the time. Depends on your mind and your interest and how deep you want to go. But if you're full of doubts, don't think that's a sign you haven't got faith. The opposite to faith is fear. The opposite to faith is unwillingness to take that next step in the dark while you're doubting. That's what faith is. You can be, well, you know it, you can be full of doubts, but fundamentally there's this sense of rightness about something that you persevere in loving, even if you don't know whether it's going to work for your kids or for anybody. But we persevere in this way of life that Jesus showed us, and we don't let fear stop us from love one another as I have loved you. So Jesus got up and rebuked the winds and the sea, and there was a dead calm. Now, how does Jesus rebuke the winds and the sea and bring about calm? I don't know. I'm full of doubts. Finally, of course, this is our faith in the resurrection. You know, the peace that comes across many people when they're dying. Some of you nursing sisters might have seen, and you've got your stories about that. The peace that you see in a person dying often is a graced peace. It's amazing. Even the sacrament of anointing can be an extraordinary sacrament of peace bringing to people. Because of their faith, they expect something beautiful of it, and they find their heart less tortured, and they find a deep inner peace that helps them go through the awfulness of parting from loved ones and death, which is facing all of us. And in many other ways, people can find a deep peace within to enable them to continue the struggle of their life.